We are broadcasting now a speech by the Right Honourable Winston S. Churchill, First Lord of the Admiralty. He is speaking at the Free Trade Hall, Manchester. This is one of a series of speeches which are being made by members of the War Cabinet throughout the country. I believe at this moment the Lord Mayor of Manchester is making his introductory remarks, and so without further delay, we take you now to the Free Trade Hall, Manchester.
When he speaks, whether it's to a meeting or on the wireless, people listen. And what they say is, well, that's straight from the shoulder. Now, it's no need to formally introduce him. The red light's gone on here. The broadcasting people are waiting. I'm not going to keep you from your treat. I'm going to call on the Right Honourable Winston Churchill, His Majesty's Minister for the Navy, the Admiralty, to address you. And I'm sure that you'll have the reception that the Lancashire audience always gives to a good Britisher. I want to ask our friends, the photographers, not to interrupt after Mr. Churchill starts speaking. It is not fair to him or the audience. They've had many a shot just now. They want another get it done with and get on with the meeting. The last one, gentlemen. Thank you. Come on, sir. Have a look.
Huh? You've been very good to me, haven't you?
I was watching the mission. I'm on the wire now.
Ladies and gentlemen, during my 40 years of public life, I have addressed many meetings in this famous hall, but never one like this. We've been for 5 months at war against the world's greatest military power and the world's greatest air power. When the war began in September, most of us expected that very soon our cities would be torn and charred by explosion and by fire, and very few, I think, would have dared to plan for the end of January 1940, a splendid gathering such as I see before me this afternoon. I know of nothing more remarkable in the long history of this country than the willingness to encounter the unknown and to face and endure whatever might be coming to us, which was shown in September last by the whole mass of the people of this island in the discharge of what they felt, what they profoundly felt was their duty. There never was a war which seemed so likely to carry its terrors at once into every home, and there never was a war in which the whole people entered with the same united conviction that, God helping, they could do no other. This was no war planned and entered upon by a government or a class or a party. On the contrary, the government labored for peace to the very end. And during those last days, the only fear in Britain was lest, weighted down by their awful responsibilities, the government should fail to rise to the height of the occasion. They did not fail. And the Prime Minister led us forward in one great body into a struggle against aggression and oppression, against wrongdoing, faithlessness, and cruelty, from which there can be no turning back. We cannot tell what the course of the struggle will be. We cannot tell into what regions it may carry us, or how long it will last, or who will fall by the way. But we are sure that in the end, right will win, that freedom will not be trampled down, that a truer progress will open, and that a broader justice will reign. We are sure of this, and we are determined to play our part worthily, faithfully, and to the end. So far, my Lord Mayor, the war in the West has fallen almost solely upon the Royal Navy and upon those parts of the Royal Air Force which give the Navy invaluable aid. The naval war opened at full pitch from the very first moment, and the most intense efforts were made by the enemy and are being made at this moment to destroy the seaborne commerce by which we live, and to starve us into submission. No considerations of humanity, no respect for the laws and conventions of war, even those to which Germany had recently and loudly protested her adherence, no injury to friendly neutrals, none of these have deterred Herr Hitler and his accomplices from wreaking their malice upon us to the utmost of their power. Our merchant ships and the ships of almost every neutral seagoing country have been sunk at sight. The approaches to our harbors have been strewn by mines of a novel character contrary to international rule, but long prepared in Germany in time of peace. Even humble fishing boats have been attacked with incendiary bombs and left to burn, and their crews left to drown, assisted by machine gun fire. Surface raiders have been out upon the trade routes, and our Navy has had to cope with all these various forms of attack. I have been taught by hard experience, and I am always very careful not to give way to over-optimism or jubilation or to make extravagant predictions of success. But I think you will agree that up to date, the Navy has not failed the nation. Continual losses there have been, and continual losses there will be. When you remember that we have hundreds of warships always running risks upon the sea in order to protect thousands of British and neutral merchant ships spread about the vast ocean spaces of the globe, or crowding in to our island gateways, when you remember that, you will, I am sure, realize that we shall have to pay a steady, regular, unrelenting toll for the maintenance of the mastery of the seas. Many hundreds of naval homes in our dockyard cities have been darkened by irreparable loss. I am sure the sympathy, aye, and the affection of the British people go out to our sailor men, Royal Navy, merchant marine, trawlers, minesweepers, fisher folk, and all who love them and depend upon them as they toil by day and by night upon the dangerous stormy waters, doing their duty with unrivaled skill and with cheerful, unquestioning courage, that we may eat our daily bread each day and that our cause may prosper. So far, marked success has attended our naval efforts. German trade and shipping have been swept from the seas. German imports of vital war material have been decisively curtailed. German exports have been practically cut off. The pocket battleship which ventured to raid in the South Atlantic has been destroyed in a brilliant action. The first attack of the U-boats has been mastered, and deadly losses have been inflicted upon them. At least half the U-boats with which the enemy began this war have been destroyed. And their new building has so far fallen far short of what we originally estimated and I mentioned to the House of Commons. We have seen the U-boat driven from using the gun to using the torpedo, and largely driven from using the torpedo to laying the stealthy mine. We have no doubt that the mining menace will be severe and costly to meet. But we think our science is superior in several very important ways to that of the enemy, and we see no reason why the mining menace should not be brought into a control as effective as it was in the last war. Let no one therefore be disheartened when he reads of daily losses, or listens to them reiterated by the BBC. Let all remember that now, at the end of months of five months of vehement naval war, it is 500-1 against any ship which obeys Admiralty instructions and joins a British convoy It is 500-1 against its being sunk. And that out of nearly 7,500 ships convoyed to and from this island, only 15 have been lost. That our convoy system is becoming more refined and rapid as the weeks go by. That the volume of our exports and imports inevitably checked by the change from peace to war, is now steadily rising again, that the ships we have captured and the ships we have built have almost made good the losses we have suffered. And that very important reinforcements are approaching both our Navy and our merchant shipping in order to meet new dangers and new assaults which may very easily come upon us in the future. My Lord Mayor, we have embarked upon a widespread system of rationing. That is not because there is danger of famine, or because the Navy has not done its part in keeping open the oceans, the seas, and the harbors. We are rationing ourselves because we wish to save every ton of imports in order to increase our output of munitions and to maintain and extend our export trade, thus gaining the foreign credits wherewith to buy more munitions and more materials of war, in order that the whole life energy of the British nation and of the British Empire and of our allies may be directed to the last ounce and to the last inch upon the task we have in hand. It is no time for ease and comfort. It is a time to dare and to endure. That is why we are rationing ourselves. Even while our resources are expanding, we are severely curtailing our consumption. That is why we mean to regulate every ton that is carried across the sea and to make sure that it is carried only for the purposes of victory. But now, my Lord Mayor, let me, on this question of food, turn from the sea to the land, and from those who plow the main to those who plow, or who should plow, the manor. Let me now, on this question of food, turn from the sea to the land. In our national effort, as we have just seen, there may be need For many kinds of activity. And there is room for all, or almost all, men and women, old and young, to serve in one way or another. We must plough up the land. We must organize our agriculture up to at least the 1918 scale. We must grow more food, and we must accommodate ourselves as much as possible to eat the kind of foods we can grow. The cost of living must, as far as possible, be kept down by producing an abundance of simple foods and necessaries. In this way, we may lighten the task of the Navy. In this way, we may increase its mobility and free its striking forces for offensive action. We do not wish indefinitely to continue merely awaiting the blows which have struck us and then responding in good kind. We hope the day will come when we shall hand over that job to Hitler. When that job will be transferred to Herr Hitler, and when he will be wondering where he is going to be struck next. My Lord Mayor, I have no doubt, and gentlemen, I have no doubt that from time to time you ask yourselves the question, why is it we have not yet been attacked from the air? Why is it that these severe ordeals for which we had braced ourselves on the outbreak of war have not been imposed upon us during these long 5 months? That is a question I am always turning over in my mind. And like so many other questions in this war, it is very difficult to answer. Is it that they are saving it for some orgy of frightfulness which will soon come upon us? Or is it because so far they have not dared? Is it because they dread the superior quality of our fighter aircraft, and because they have feared the massive counterstroke which they would immediately receive? No one can say for certain, but one thing is sure. It is not from any false sense of delicacy that they have so far refrained from subjecting us to this new and odious form of warfare. Nor is it out of love and kindness. We know from what they did in Poland that there is no brutality or bestial massacre of civilians by air bombing which they would not readily commit upon us if they thought it for their advantage. But for the present, here is a chapter of war which they have not chosen to open upon us, because I suppose they cannot tell what may be written on its final pages. But then the question arises, and is often put, ought we to have begun ourselves? Ought we, instead of demonstrating the power of our air force by dropping leaflets all over Germany, to have dropped bombs? Well, there, my Lord Mayor, I am quite clear that our policy has been right. In this peaceful country, governed by public opinion, by democracy, and by parliament, we were not as thoroughly prepared at the outbreak of war as this dictator state, whose whole thought was bent on the preparation for war. Every one of you knows how far better organized we are now, and how much stronger our defenses of all kinds are than they were at the beginning of the war. We have striven hard to make the most of the time of preparation which has been gained. And there is no doubt that an enormous advance has been made, both in the protection of the civil population and in the punishment which would be inflicted upon the raiders. Not only have our air defenses and shelters been substantially improved, but our army at home and abroad, which is now large, has been steadily maturing in training and in quality. And the whole preparation of our munition industries under the spur of war has rolled forward with a gathering momentum. Therefore, I feel I was right in saying in one of my earliest broadcasts that if we reach the spring without any interruption of our seaborne trade and without anything serious happening on land or in the air, we should, in fact, have gained the opening campaign of the war. I am thankful that this country has now got into its war stride and has mobilized a large part of its immense resources and is mobilizing the rest. It will be said, the other side are doing this too. They too are expanding their armies, are expanding their armies. They too are increasing and improving their air force. But we must remember that Germany has been going for more than 3 years at full wartime pace. And it may well be that they have no large, untapped reserve of manpower or material or of life energy to draw upon so as to enable them to make an additional spurt. We, on the other hand, had much slack to take up. Indeed, the greater part of our national life had to be turned over from peace to war. We have not taken up all our slack yet by any means, or there would not still be 1,300,000 unemployed, of which at least half could play their part. But the process is expanding every day, and the pace is growing quicker. And therefore, I cannot doubt that these extra months of preparation have been a godsend to us, and that whatever may happen in the future, provided we do not relax our vigilance, Herr Hitler has already lost his best chance. My Lord Mayor, we cannot place in the field immediately the great armies which we need and which we are determined to form, and for which millions of eager men stand ready. We have to increase very largely on manufacture of munitions and equipment of every kind. The immense plants and factories which are needed can only gradually come into full production. We are, of course, much further ahead than we were at this time in the last war. And guided by the experience of that war, we ought to make a far more rapid progress. But we have to make a huge expansion of our labor force, and especially of those capable of performing skilled or semi-skilled operations. Here we must especially count for aid and for guidance upon our labor colleagues and trade union leaders. I can speak with some knowledge about this, having presided over the former Ministry of Munitions in its culminating phase. I tell you, millions of new workers will be needed, and more than a million women must come boldly forward into the shell plants and munition filling factories and munition works, and above all, into the aircraft industry. If trade unionists from patriotic or international motives lay aside for the duration of the war any of those special craft usages which they have so carefully built up, they need have no fear that these will not be fully restored to them after the war is won. Nearly a million women were employed in the last war in 1918 under the Ministry of Munitions. They did all kinds of things that no one ever expected them to do, and they did them very well. But after the war was over, they went back home and were no obstacle to the resumption of normal conditions of British life and labor. Without this expansion of labor, and without allowing the women of Britain to enter the struggle as they desire to do, we should fail utterly to bear our fair share of the burden which France and Britain have jointly assumed, which we must carry forward together to the end, or perish miserably in slavery and ruin. My Lord Mayor, during this time of war, great powers are entrusted to the executive government. Nevertheless, we exercise them under the constant supervision of Parliament and with a wide measure of free debate. We have a stern and resolute House of Commons. A House of Commons which is not likely at all to flag or weaken in this conflict upon which it entered unanimously. And I do not doubt that it is a House of Commons which would be perfectly ready, if emergency required it, to approve and to enforce all measures required for the safety of the state. During the last 250 years, the British Parliament has fought several great European wars with unwearied zeal and tenacity, and has carried them all to a successful conclusion. In this war, In this war, they are fighting not only for themselves, but for parliamentary institutions wherever they have been set up all over the globe. In our country, public men are proud to be the servants of the people. They would be ashamed to be their masters. Ministers of the Crown feel themselves strengthened by having at their side the House of Commons and the House of Lords, sitting with great regularity and seeking out continual opportunities of stimulating their activities. Of course, it is quite true that there is often severe criticism of the government in both houses. We do not resent the well-meant criticism of any man who wishes to win the war. We do not shrink even from fair criticism, and that is the most dangerous of all. On the contrary, we take it earnestly to heart and seek to profit by it. Criticism in the body, my Lord Mayor, in the body politic, criticism in the state, is like pain in the human body. It is not pleasant, but where would the body be without it? No, there could be no health or sensibility without it, without the continued correctives and warnings of pain. It is this fear of criticism that the Nazi and Bolshevik dictatorships, it is in this fear of criticism that they run their greatest risk. They silence all criticism by the concentration camp, by the rubber truncheon, or the firing party. And thus the men at the top must very often be fed only with the facts which are palatable to them. Scandals, corruption, and shortcomings are not exposed because there are no independent voices. Instead of being exposed, they continue to fester behind the pompous facade of the state. The men at the top may be very fierce and very powerful, but their ears are deaf, their fingers are numb. They cannot feel their feet as they move forward in the fog and darkness of the immeasurable and of the unknown. One of the things this war is going to prove is whether in modern times the full strength of nations can be realized for war under totalitarian systems working through an Ogpu or a Gestapo. That is one of the things which is going to be found out. Certainly, what we have seen of the Russian war effort when opposed by the heroic Finns should give the British and French democracies and parliaments additional confidence in their own struggle with the Nazi despotism, which is an equally hateful, though more efficient form of the communist despotism. It is through the influence and support of the House of Commons that we have been able to carry through the great and severe financial measures which have been needed. A budget so fierce and heavy that it has altered decisively the way of living for all the income tax payers of the country, and which also impose new burdens upon the wage-earning classes. Such a budget has been accepted without a murmur. this heavy increase of taxation and the marked success which has already crowned the savings movement are indispensable aids to the maintenance of our credit and to upholding the great borrowing operations which will be required as the war proceeds. It is remarkable and significant that in the midst of war, with the whole world in its present lamentable state, we have been able to carry through a conversion, reducing the interest on one of our loans from 4.5% to 2%. Indeed, in the financial field, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, upon whom so many burdens fall, and from whom so many burdens fall, is building up a veritable Maginot line of financial strength and confidence. And I think it will be noted by historians in the future that the British nation, even when fighting for its life, did not deny its compassion to the aged poor, and that an old age pension debt has not been excluded even in these hard times. In finance, also, we have made arrangements with the French Republic, which are without precedent between allies, and which are another proof of the intimacy which unites the fortunes of the two Western democracies, so that in every sphere, not only during the war, but after it has been gained, they will be able to act for mutual preservation as one. And let us take occasion here and now to express our admiration for the war effort of France. The splendid army which holds back the superior numbers of the enemy, the fine French navy, their rapidly growing air force, together with the moral and intellectual contribution which France makes to the struggle, all make us realize how hard we shall have to work not to be excelled by our ally in our effort for the common cause. I had, my Lord Mayor, I've had the unique experience of holding the same important office at the beginning of the last war a quarter of a century ago as I do now. And therefore, I am able to make comparisons in my own mind which perhaps are not open to others. I always hesitate to say anything which seems to underrate the formidable character of the foe we have to fight. Yet I cannot rid my mind of the feeling that the Imperial Germany of 1914 was a stronger community than the Nazi Germany which now confronts us. The whole German people sprang to arms with enthusiasm and ardor. The haggard, hard-driven party regime which the Nazis have raised and reared from defeat and hatred may function for a while with terrible precision, but whether it has the same solidity or power to endure reverses, which was shown by the Kaiser's Germany, has yet to be proved. And we mean to put it to the proof. Moreover, my Lord Mayor, even if we look at numbers alone, we have no need to feel that the task we have taken up is beyond our compass. I cannot pretend or venture to forecast what the course of this war will be, whether it will be long or short, whether it will be dull and grinding or burst suddenly into furious flame. But I am quite sure that the British Empire and the French Republic and French Empire, once they have got on the move, and they are on the move, are far stronger together in physical energy and in psychic strength than Hitler's Germany. He boasts that he has 90 millions under his rod. But nearly 20 of those millions have to be forcibly held down by the others. We have 85 millions in our homelands alone. And 20 millions more in the British Dominions, whose armies are hastening to the battlefront. And besides this, there are those vast populations of men of other races who owe allegiance to the Crown or to the French Republic, who are spread about the entire surface of the globe, and whose sure instinct leads them to regard Nazism as a deadly menace to their future progress. All these inexhaustible forces will steadily and surely, through the command of the sea, be brought to bear upon that evil thing whose wickedness has cast its shadow upon mankind and seeks to bar the forward march. My Lord Mayor, let us look for a moment before I close at what Nazi Germany inflicts upon the peoples she has subjugated to her rule. The German invaders pursue with every method of cultural, social, and economic oppression their intention of destroying the Czech nation. Students are shot by the scores and tormented in concentration camps by thousands. All the Czech universities have been closed. Amongst them was the Charles University of Prague, which, founded in 1348, was the first university in Central Europe. Closed. The clinics, the laboratories, the libraries of the Czech universities have been pillaged or destroyed. The works of their national writers have been removed from the public libraries. More than 2,000 periodicals and newspapers have been suppressed. Prominent writers, artists, professors have been herded in the concentration camps. Public administration and the judicature have been reduced to chaos. The Czech lands have been plundered, and every scrap of food or useful portable article has been carried off into Germany by organized brigandage or common theft. The property of the churches has been maladministered by German commissars. 100,000 Czech workmen have been led off into slavery to be toiled to death in Germany. 8 millions of Czechs, a nation famous and recognizable as a distinct community from many centuries past in Europe, this nation writhed in agony under the German and the Nazi tyranny. But I can assure you that everything that is happening to the Czechs pales in comparison with the atrocities which, as I speak here this afternoon, are being perpetrated upon the Poles. In German-occupied Poland, the most hideous forms of terrorism prevail. In this, there are two distinct phases. In the first, the Germans tried to cow the population by shooting individuals picked at random from the towns. At one place where they had decided to shoot 35 people, they collected 34 victims, and then, finding they were one short, went into a chemist's shop and seized the first person they found to make up the tally. But later, when they became more discriminating, they made a careful search for the natural leaders of Polish life, the nobles, the landowners, the priests, as well as prominent workmen and peasants. It is estimated that upwards of 15,000 intellectual leaders have been shot. These horrible mass executions are a frequent occurrence. At one place, 300 are lined up against the wall. At another, a group of drunken German officers are said to have shot 70 hostages in prison. At another, 136 Polish students, some of whom were only between 12 and 13 years of age, were butchered. Torture has been used. Press gangs seize men and women in the streets and drive them off in droves to forced labor in Germany. Famine stalks not only amid the ruins of Warsaw, but far and wide throughout that ancient country, which a few months ago was the home of a people of over 35 million, with a history extending back far beyond anything that Germany can boast. The horror and the inexcusable excesses committed on helpless and homeless people, declares the papal broadcast from the Vatican of the 22nd of this month, have been established by the unimpeachable testimony of eyewitnesses. The crowning iniquity, says the Vatican broadcast, lies in the cynical suppression of all but the merest suggestion of religious worship in the lives of one of the most pious and devotional of the peoples of Europe. From these shameful records, we may judge what our own fate would be if we fell into their clutches. But from them also, we may draw the force and inspiration to carry us forward upon our journey, and not to pause or rest until liberation is achieved and justice done. Come then, men and women of Manchester, let us to the task, to the battle, to the toil, each to our part, each to our station. Fill the armies, dominate the air, pour out the munitions, strangle the U-boats, sweep the mines, plow the land, build the ships, guard the streets, succor the wounded, uplift the downcast, and honor the brave. Let us go forward together in all parts of the empire, in all parts of the island. There is not a week, nor a day, nor an hour to lose.
Direct from London, England, Mutual has brought you an address by the Right Honorable Winston Churchill, First Lord of the Admiralty. The broadcast was presented through the cooperation of the British Broadcasting Corporation. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.